Bahu jo ne heo no anda heo one ne heo ne heo one. Bahu jo ne heo no anda heo one ne heo ne heo one. Bahu jo ne heo no anda heo one ne heo ne heo one. Bahu jo ne heo no anda heo one ne heo na he ne yo.
Good day to all of you out there. This is Robert Itis and Plants and Their Friends, which is on WART FM 95.5. And we have with us today a guest, John Watkins is with
Enchanted Valley Plants.
Enchanted Valley Plants up on 2570.
Yeah, it's 9535 2570.
Yes.
Marshall, North Carolina.
Yes, John's been someone I've known now with the farmers market for a while. Used to be down in Hot Springs only. Now he has a place up here in Marshall. So we're about to begin the show with a plant that has come up recently called Trillium. And there's a special trillium that runs along the French Broad River Valley. And it's called Trillium luteum. L-U-T-E-U-M. And it is luteum means yellow trillium. And so it's an interesting situation where this is one of many different trilliums that we have in the area, right, John?
Right.
And yeah,
there are probably 20 or 30 different varieties of trillium here in the mountain. That includes the Catsby's trillium, They're just beautiful, growing all over these mountains.
Well, I at Eagle Feather Farm have not only this trillium, Trillium luteum, at my farm. It was there when I got there, and we have brought in other trillium since then. And right next to me is a bunch of nodding trillium, which is also a very interesting plant. We used to have some trillium Florida. You remember that?
I'm not sure what you're
I think
talking.
It's let me think about that one. And then of course there's the wake robin, which is probably one of the most famous trilliums. Do you have any old lore about trilliums being used for medicine?
No, I don't. I knew old guy back in the early 70s, he was all over these mountains. He raised all different kinds of trillium, and he sold it, but he never mentioned the medical value of any of it.
Well, it's pretty rare now. It has a beneficial aspect to trying to get over a cold, but I think there are a lot better plants out there for colds, like Echinacea and Golden Seal. So, and it's been over harvested for sure. We would encourage everybody to do some Trillium work on their land. And by that I mean, if you took a Trillium pot in a pot and it's flowering. Now, how many years to flower?
They'll flower first year. They'll spread from when you first plant them. If they're small, they will spread like the second year. There'll be three or four in a cluster, and then the third year there'll be like eight or ten. I've dug them like 25 or 30 in one cluster.
Yeah, it takes a while for that flower to come out on these Trillium, and but once you get them out in flowering, then they throw their seeds, and if you put them up near the top of your hill, it will throw seeds down, and then if it's in a pot, you know, you bury the pot in the ground, then you can move the pot from that location 1 year to another location the next year, and it'll keep doing that. It'll keep throwing Trillium down that hillside, which is a nice way to get a bunch of Trillium in an area, because you want to keep them out. Trillium is one of those plants that likes to be near other Trilliums. You'll come across a bunch of them together, and it's really very interesting how they work. I believe that there's some mycorrhizal activity with the Trillium in the growing.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is a very unusual plant in the Trillium range. There are a lot of them. It basically, Trillium lutein will be in this French Broad River Valley, and it is a Trillium that doesn't have a stem. So the nodding Trillium or the wake robin will have a stem, and it won't. And if it has a stem, it usually doesn't have the two colored leaves. If it has two colored leaves, both the red and the yellow, the flower happens right down at the base where the leaves come out. So that's a little bit different. That there are Trilliums, and then they're Trilliums that look a little bit different as far as the leaves go, and as far as whether they have a stem or not. Anything that you can remember about Trillium lutein? Any stories that?
No, I just know the old timers, you know, they got the ginseng and the Trillium and the shooting star plants, like a rattlesnake plant out of the mountains. This old guy made his living that way.
Yeah. Yeah, so there's a lot of Trillium that have left. There's an opportunity to purchase this. It's one of the spring ephemerals, so it's not going to stick around very long. Goes down, when would you say, in June?
Yeah, they only last 2 or 3 weeks.
Yeah.
Now, 3 weeks they'll be gone.
A couple of weeks they'll be gone. So that's... an interesting aspect about the Trilliums, that they're part of that spring ephemeral, the flowering early plants. And they really have a wonderful beauty to them as a flowering plant. Now, one of the things with the Trillium lutein is that it has a smell to it, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah, lemon smell, yeah.
That lemon smell is very interesting because there's another Trillium that looks like this, that they're identical, but it's down in Transylvania County. Have you heard about that one? And the only difference is that it smells different.
Yeah, they get a lot of them from South Carolina, too.
Yeah?
A lot of Trillium comes out of South Carolina.
Well, yeah, it could be. This one Trillium is, I know, on the endangered list in North Carolina. It only comes out of a little section in Transylvania County. And it has a smell the way the Trillium lutein that we have here smells lemonly. It has a spicy smell to it. And that's the only way to differentiate between the two plants. But it is very endangered. Those people who are possibly streaming this program out of Brevard area know that you have a very, very rare Trillium, yellow Trillium, that has a spicy smell to it. And if you find one of those, you'd be really, really lucky. And we need to propagate these individual Trilliums a lot more than we have been. They're not a hard plant to propagate, are they?
Oh, no. They're real easy.
Yeah, and then they have this kind of bulbous...
Yeah, that bulb.
Bulb root, and then little rootlets coming out from that. And they're one of the few plants that I find does not mind being in a pot. It, you know, it can come up in the pot. It can go down in the pot. You can put it away, and next year bring it up.
Right,
it'll come up, come right back up. Yeah, and that's a great aspect of the Trillium for sure. And they're all like that. They are delicate, and with these high winds, with those Trilliums with the stems and being knocked over and everything, it's really tough. One of the things that I learned, which was a hard lesson for me. About this a Trillium a presentation to the public in a pot is in the beginning I used to take out all of the leaves. So we take the pot, say the Trillium had broken and we couldn't sell it. It didn't have the top anymore. We put it away for next year. We would put a bunch of leaves on it for the winter. And then in the springtime, we would take those leaves off of there. And at one point, I used to take all of the leaves off of there and have the plant up. But it didn't do real well. It actually is as you see it in the forest, is a plant that comes right through those leaves. And it actually uses those leaves to help it stand up. And so if you do put a Trillium in a pot, you should put... broken up leaves around it to help it stand up. If it falls over and hits the plastic, it's usually gone. And then you have to put it back for the next year when it comes up again. That's one of the things that I have learned about this plant. It really is a very interesting and it spreads very easily. You usually work with plants rather than seeds with this?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, the root, yeah.
Yeah. And so there are pots of this plant, if you want to start them in your woods, that John has... at Enchanted Valley, and that I have at Eagle Feather Farm. And as I say, you don't need, if it's a flowering Trillium, it will throw off small guys downhill from the first time you put the pot out there. So you don't need a lot of them. You just need a lot of patience that it'll take a little bit of time to get that hillside to have a lot of Trillium on it, but it's a pretty, pretty sight. An early spring ephemeral that we are so lucky with in this mountain area, and especially along the French Broad River, to have this trillium in large, large, large numbers. The red trillium, I know that there are certain places like Black Mountain or Hickory or Hendersonville that have a lot of red trillium.
A lot of the red and the pink come from South Carolina.
The which ones?
The red and the pink.
Red and pink. Yeah, on the leaves. I mean, on the flowers. Yeah. That's probably true. But trilliums are a very folklore-y type part of our mountain tradition for the spring. Trilliums and spring beauties, the toothwort, those coming up early are just magical to walk through the forest with them all out. Don't you think, John?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, out Avery County and Yankton County, there are just millions of them out there. I found the most in probably Yankton County.
Yeah, Yancey County, a little less developed than where we are here, so that it would be a little less disturbing the environment with all of the housing and stuff. Okay, well, that is the very first part of our show today. This is Plants and Their Friends, WART 95.5 on your FM dial. We are broadcasting from the caboose in downtown Marshall on Main Street. And we are very, very proud to bring the plants onto this platform for everybody out there. So the second portion that we're going to start talking about now is I have John Watkins here from a nursery that's up on 2570. And we're going to talk about one of John's specialties. Besides Trillium lutens, he has quite a few pawpaws. And as far as I've known him, maybe 15 years,
yeah.
He has always had pawpaw trees and knows a great deal about them. I came out of my gate a few days ago, maybe a week ago, and saw my flowering pawpaws. Right now, and had to go out and get some chicken, but we'll go into that in a second here. But John, let's talk about how this plant, a tree, small tree, is out there, and how you got to know it.
Yeah, I've got to know the pawpaws up from East Tennessee over here. I lived at Del Rio, and I had a friend who was a game warden for about 45 years on that Swan property from the other side of Newport all the way into the mountains over there. And there were some of the pawpaws on that property like 5 miles wide. I've never seen as many pawpaws as I have in my life as we were there. And I was raising them, and a guy stopped to buy some one day, and he said, "I'm a plant specialist." I said, "Well, I'm a plant specialist too, but this guy really is." I think there are 40 of them. They travel to a different state each year, taste testing these wild, rare plants. And my 1035 pawpaw came, he took mine to Indiana. It came in first in a taste test in Indiana about 6 years ago. I raised about 3 or 4 different kinds of pawpaw, and most of them were grafted on the North American pawpaw, which is probably the most common in America. That pawpaw grow from Canada, right? I've got them growing in Key West, Florida. But they won't grow in that salt water. I've got friends that raise them in Louisiana, and I've got friends that raise them in North Dakota. So it's a real hardy plant for almost any part of America in this hemisphere.
Yeah, it looks like the Latin name is Asimina triloba.
Triloba.
Yeah. It is a beautiful fruit. Now, let's talk about the... I just said I was hanging up a piece of chicken on it. Tell us about how it propagates.
I put my I use mesh wire on a T-pole and put it near the tree so animals won't climb. If you put it on the tree, they'll try to climb that tree and damage your tree. But I put mine on a T-pole for about the last 10 or 15 years, and it attracts flies. A bee or a butterfly will not pollinate the pawpaw. And the pawpaw is both male and female. And early on, when the pawpaw blooms, the pollen on it will be light-colored, and that's the female stage of the pawpaw. And then after about a week or 10 days, that pollen will turn dark brown or black, and that's the male stage of the pawpaw. And you only need one. And I started out with one, and I developed many, many from that one pawpaw. So you can go to these nurses, and they'll tell you you need two or three or four or five, and you don't.
Yeah, and I can attest to the fact that I just have one at my gate. I don't have two. And I had heard that a rumor about, oh, you need a second one to really do it, but as it turned out, John, I tried that, and that second one never got going, and the first one just kept coming, and now the whole tree, it must be 20 foot tall, is covered with flowers.
Yeah.
So, but I'm glad that we talked about it, because I did attach the chicken bone to the tree. And I need to take that off and put it on bamboo next to it.
Near the tree, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, that's what I'm going to need. Well, as soon as I get home, that's going to be on my list of things to do. So this, and that's interesting, because for a long time, I didn't realize that they needed flies instead of the bees and the wasps and everything else. So that was a learning curve for me. I'm just so happy now to know about this. Last year, there's a pawpaw grove near UNCA that's in the back of this lady's house. And we got pawpaws from that grove, and we made a, I don't know, what do we make, like a mush kind of dessert out of it. And we need to talk about when you harvest the pawpaw. That's really important. Yeah, why don't we deal with that right now?
Yeah, the pawpaw probably 5 or 6, 8, 10 years ago, it was the last of August. Now the pawpaw gets ripe from the 1st of August to around the middle of August. There's a Facebook, on the computer, there's a bunch of people called the pawpaw fanatics. And I've never seen as many people with different ideas about their pawpaw. But some of them are good and some of them are bad. And they'll argue with you that they're good, but I've been raising this pawpaw for about 35, 40 years. And I think I've got it pretty well down pat.
Well, there's an awful lot of different terms for pawpaws. I looked up some, and You can just jump in. You know, what would you call a common term for poor poetry?
I call it American mango.
That's a hillbilly mango.
Hillbilly mango.
Hillbilly mango. Quaker delight. Small deciduous tree native to eastern United States and Canada, producing a large yellowish green to brown fruit. And it's very much some people said it was kind of like the mountain banana. In consistency. Yeah,
the old timers used to use them for bananas to make pudding out of them.
Yeah.
Before the refrigeration, and they couldn't get the bananas, they'd go to the river by French Broad River Basin and get these pawpaws. That thing will grow. I've dug them all the way down the Tennessee River. French Broad goes into the Tennessee. Tennessee River comes out. And Mobile, Alabama, I've dug them all down through Alabama on those islands, and it's the same pawpaw that's growing from Rosamond right down to French Broad all the way to Mobile, and it'll grow right down to Mississippi all the way to New Orleans, too. I've dug them down there.
Well, this is interesting that you're talking about this because of the location of where they like to grow is really important. And if you think you're going up on top of your ridge and finding a pawpaw, ain't going to happen.
Yeah, if somebody set it out up there, if it's going up on that ridge, a deer will carry that seed, but they normally travel along where there's water. They'll travel it. That seed will be 4 or 5 miles from the French Broad River, the Tennessee River, the Mississippi.
But they like water. They like water in their feet. They don't mind being flooded, and they are one of the first to kind of pop up. I saw some of them that you had today, and there's like a little bit of new growth coming up on those.
Like a little feather comes out of them on the older one now.
Little feather. So that's kind of when you're going out right now into the forest and you want to kind of see the where a pawpaw might be. They have an unusual bark, and so that's one thing you can look for, but for a bigger tree, and then look around it for these little feathers coming out of the sticky kind of ground. And then they have a couple of them coming up.
That little feather will come out right after they bloom. They'll bloom first. And then when that bloom falls off, you'll see the little pawpaw sticking there where the bloom is. If you pollinate or you use a little meat attract fly to pollinate it.
Yeah, that's the important thing. But if you want to plant the pawpaw, you want to plant it near water. You'll have your best results that way.
Oh, yeah, I found them growing in no stagnant water didn't make you sick. An old logging trail about 100 years old where I found the two prettiest pawpaws I ever seen in my life growing. And I dug them on. They was really well. Done really well. That water would make you sick they were growing in.
Yeah. And there's a situation where if you ate that pawpaw before it got ripe, that...
Well, turn you wrong side out.
it would get into you, wouldn't it? And what are the kind of consequences of that? So almost like a food poisoning?
Yeah, the pawpaw itself, every part of it except the fruit is toxic. I don't mean it's poison, but if you eat enough of it, it'll hurt you. The leaves, the bark, they make several different kinds of cancer. Medicines out of the bark, I'm pretty sure, of the leaves, too. I've sold them to a lot of people to treat cancer with, but I don't know anything about that.
Yeah, that's just a rumor there, hearsay. Some of these things could be followed through and research looked at it. The tree is interesting. It definitely is one that if humans intervene, there could be a better germination.
Oh, yeah.
So tell us about how that happens. If that fruit just falls down on the ground, it kind of rots out. It really has to have like a hole and the rain come for it to be real successful. But if we as human beings take the pulp and make some food out of it and then take that seed, and what do we want to stratify that?
Yeah, the seed, if the seed becomes a North American pawpaw once it develops that fruit on the tree, no matter what kind of pawpaw, you'll hear all kinds of tales about it. I've got three different pawpaws growing on one tree in Hot Springs. It's probably 30 feet high right now, 30, 35 feet high. But pawpaw will get 100 feet high, but it'll take it 100 years. Most of them in the wild are between 20, 25 feet high, the biggest they get.
That's great. That's good information. So you're trying to see a kind of smallish tree, maybe witch hazel type size, from seedling going on up that we have here. Of course, when they logged this tree, it would get zapped real easy on falling timbers all around it. It's not, you know, can't stand up to any of that. We have done a bunch of good work with the pawpaw and the Trillium lutein. What I would like to tell you right now, since we're about halfway through the show, is that you've been listening to Plants and Their Friends on WART FM 95.5 on your FM dial. Our program is on Saturday morning at 10 o'clock and Tuesday evening at 8 o'clock right now. And we want everybody to get ready for the possibility this year of providing from fruit fermentation to make your own alcohol that is happening more and more in this community around Marshall. And of course, making honey mead alcohol is pretty big right now also. I was going to try and talk to John, my guest today, about his experience in making fruit alcohol wine.
Oh, yeah. A man lived on Meadowtown Road, made wine and had a government stamp back in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s. Taught me how to make this wine. It's not nothing new on this market here at Marshall. I asked the mayor if he knew the guy that taught me how to make that wine. I gave him a quart when Lawrence Ponder was the mayor here, and he really, really liked that. He said he knew that guy well, and he had drank that wine before.
Well, there's an aspect of this that I want to let everybody know about, and I believe that as long as you don't sell it, you can give it away.
Oh, yeah.
And so this becomes something that was part of the old tradition of having something that was fairly valuable, but it was something that you shared with the community, whoever made it and whoever could understand the process. So going through the process is, if I remember right, and you just jump in, John, you have to first get some fruit.
Right.
And you've done some of the testing I've had with you is pear.
Oh, yeah, I've had
cherry.
Pear, cherry, peach, plum. My plums will be the next productive fruit to make the wine out of. And I've made it out of the pawpaw. I only made 2 gallons, and it didn't last long. It was just absolutely delicious wine.
So there you are. So you have to first gather your fruit. So you either will grow these fruit, or you will gather them, or you will purchase them from somebody. And now we have the fruit. We've got to put it into some kind of glass jar, and we're going to add alcohol. Now, the types of alcohol that are out there are varied, so you want to make sure that you are using the right kind of alcohol. The alcohol that I use in my tinctures, which pulls out the medicine from the root crops like ginseng or golden seal, I use at 190 proof. But I don't think you have to get up there to start off with this wine at all. And people go down into vodka or brandy to make some of this wine.
Yeah, you have to run that through a still to make the brandy or whiskey. I make my wine out of just spring water. You can't use this town or city water. But I make mine out of spring water, and I blend it in a blender with my fruits, like my plums. I put a couple of double handful of plums in there, put about 2 cups of confectioner sugar. I put my spring water in there, bring it up 3/4 of a quart, and I blend it, and I put it in a gallon jar, and I put a rubber surgical glove on it and wrap a rubber band around it so that no air gets in, no air gets out. And that's why I have some of the best wine in this part of the country.
Now, there are these brewing, making your own beer kind of places that making wine. And they have a topped kind of cork to it that has a little piece of glass thing, a bubble that the air can escape from, that I've seen Mark use on his meads. And I know that I've had wine from you, and you have to be careful because it can explode.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's a big thing. So if you have one of these locks, these air locks that can let the air out, it won't explode as easily. How many explosions have you had?
I've had a bunch of them. But by using that confection of sugar, makes it more bubbly, and it's more apt to blow the cork out of it. If you shake it up or turn it over on the side, it'll blow that cork out.
And the fact that you mentioned the water, that you shouldn't be using city water or water that has a lot of chlorine in it, that is really important, because if you didn't know that, we wouldn't have said anything about it. You would have just taken your fruit and city water and put it in there, and that would have not been a good thing. So go the extra mile and get some spring water. That's an element. And then let's just talk for a second about the element of the sugar that is going to act as a fermenter. And, yeah, and you can do that with sugar, you can do it with honey, and you can do it with maple syrup. Any of those will cause this reaction to take place. So those people who are not wanting to do sugar per se, they're intolerant to that, then there are alternatives.
Yeah, but the more sugar you put, the higher the alcohol content. But you can only get like 15% with that wine. That's about what mine is, about as high as you can get.
Well, that's a really interesting to take this and understand how you can make your own wine. You don't have to go out and buy wine. And you can know that the fruit that you start with is organic. So if you're going to just go buy a bottle of wine, of course, if it's an organic bottle of wine, you know that the grapes are organic. But this way, there's a lot of other stuff out there that's not organic. And if you don't want to put any more chemicals into your system, you can start this process with organic fruit. Now, one of the things that we have in the mountains here is wineberry. And wineberry wine I've had before. It's an interesting one. Isn't there a problem with the little tiny seeds you have to kind of strain that out first?
I ferment my seeds right in with the, I blend them right in with the wine.
You're going to put it in the blender.
And then when it finished the 21-day process of fermenting,
yeah,
and my surgical glove goes back, lays back down, I know it's ready. And you just strain it out and strain the seeds out of it, and you got your wine there.
Okay. So there's a straining process at the end before you bottle it. And now that we're getting into the bottling part of it, that's another whole area of you don't want to bottle into plastic. You want to bottle into glass. And then you have a couple of different things that you can use to hold that tight. We mentioned corks. Is there a place that you like to get your corks from?
I've still got thousands of corks people gave me.
Okay, so you recycle.
Yeah, but I had a friend work at
Recycle Reuse.
Biltmore Winery over there, and he just gave me cases of bottles and bags of corks that they served that wine at the winery on the Biltmore Estate, and then he'd give him the bottle, empty bottles and the wine and the corks.
Yeah, well, there you go. Making friends with somebody to recycle that is a great a way to go. And I know that we used to get Grove Park Inn plastic containers so that there's plenty of places to go to stop it from going into the landfill, which we have a huge problem with our landfill right now. Okay, John, we've covered a lot of territory, haven't we?
Yeah.
Yeah? You got another little plant that you want to talk about?
Maybe the hazelnut. That's a real good plant that grows almost anywhere. It loves the sun. The state used to set them out on these all these back roads so that it would hold the where they were building these new roads, and they had erosion. This is a perfect plant for any kind of erosion that you have. They make the truffles out of it. And, Dr. Tom Michaels in Chucky, Tennessee, was selling these truffles for like $3,800 a pound. But you need a $10,000 truffle dog to find these truffles.
And they like this tree. They like this tree, the truffles?
Oh, yeah. The truffles, they'll grow right on the root of the hazelnut. That's what they
hazelnuts. Yeah. So there's some kind of mycorrhizal relationship between the hazelnut and the truffle. That's an interesting situation. Hazelnuts, are they easily eaten? Can you crack the shell real easy? And
it's got a tough shell on it, but it's one of the best nuts in this part of the country. The real hazelnut are few and far between in these mountains. They've got a disease. They die real easily. If you plant 200 of them, it takes them 3 years to come up. And then half of them will be dead when they start to come up. And then the next year, half of those will be dead. And I kept one for 11 years in a planter. I was going to give it to my brother. And when I went to get it, it was dead.
Well, I know also that my hazelnut, the Japanese beetles seem to really like it.
Eat them up.
Yeah, so, I mean, usually I'll find them first on the thornless blackberries, and then I'll go down to the hazelnut, and I'll usually find some down there. Now, this is really important that the Japanese beetle is taken care of by hand. There's a couple of different thoughts about it. One is that if you put up something to catch them, you're really also attracting a lot of Japanese beetles that you don't want. So one way that we do it in the morning, we get out there and with a tub of soapy water, and if the sun is not on the beetle, they seem lethargic in the morning. And you can just flick them into the soapy water and boom, they're gone. And if you do that every morning for a number of mornings, you'll see that you'll really take down the population. And it just is that it's a maintenance situation that you have every morning that you have to get up there and do that little act of getting them. Otherwise, if you don't control it right away, they can take off and really decimate trees and bushes. Is that similar to what you have happening when?
Yeah, I got a friend. He's organic. He's a plant specialist. There's 40 of them in the United States. I didn't know there were until I met him about 20, 25 years ago. But he brings me stuff I don't even know what it is to spray on them, and it gets rid of the beetle. But he's organic, and I don't even know what this stuff is he brings me. I'm not going to tell anybody if I knew, but it sure gets rid of the beetle.
Well, I kind of like the aspect of just flicking them off into soapy water, and start your morning off like that. Let me say that this is Robert Itis with Plants and Their Friends on WART FM 95.5. And I'm with John Watkins from
Hot Springs.
Hot Springs, and his nursery is
Marshall.
Is in Marshall, and the name of the nursery is?
Enchanted Valley Plants.
Enchanted Valley Plants. And he's been around this area for quite a while. You can see him also down at the farmer's market on Sundays. He's usually down there. And you could visit him up on 2570 for the hazelnuts or for the pawpaws. He specializes in those plants and trees and bushes. And he also is one of my competitors for selling Trillium lutens, that are out there. We have a couple of more minutes before we're finished here, John. How are you? How are you doing right now? Did you say that you've got some potential of some sales?
Oh yeah, I've got the butternut also. It's almost an endangered species. Plants are really good. Walnut. It's an oblong walnut, literally. But a squirrel will eat it and leave the black walnut right beside them on a tree. And they're literally eating themselves out of something to eat. When that tree dies none of the walnuts hit the ground to reproduce, that'd be the end of that butternut or the walnut.
Yeah. Sometimes I feel that the squirrels are really tree rodents that are problems. We have a process of trapping live and taking them into the national forest. Well, John, I want to thank you for coming on the show. It's been an interesting afternoon. We will be here at the caboose for a couple more minutes now. And I just wanted to touch base with you, John, on anything that we've missed with the pawpaws, or any advice about that we possibly had forgotten about before.
Now, if you want to see them growing, I've grown them in Hot Springs. I got 140 fruiting trees on 9/10 of an acre there in Hot Springs on Short Street. You might want to see these plants growing. I've got the scuppernong, the muscadine, hazelnut, pawpaws, persimmon. I got the fuyu persimmon, the prop persimmon. They're both seedless. They're really good persimmons in my trees. I bet I got a ton off each one of them last year. They're really good. You might want to come by and see them growing on my place at 9535 Highway 2570 near Brush Creek. Come by and see the muscadines, or in season, come by and pick you some. I sell the plants also.
Well, there we are. We're knowing what we have as resources in our community for plants, and a lot of what we've been talking about is also food. And we can go back to the Greek statement of food is medicine and medicine is food. So this is part of our resiliency to be able to grow food and medicine from the plants and trees, bushes around us, naturally, the stuff that's here. We don't have to go anywhere to do it. We just have to cultivate these plants and trees and bushes so that we can benefit from all of the abundance of nature that is presented to us each season. I know that there's a very nice farmers market that we both belong to on Sunday, and we just had an opening with a bunch of kids stuff, and it was something that I think everybody in this area needs to support and be proud of, that we have a farmer's market that you don't have to go traveling anywhere too far to get to, and you can support the local farms that are in this area with your voting dollars. You're voting to support these young farmers that are here, and middle-aged farmers and old farmers that are hanging out still waiting for the young guys to come along. But we're very happy to be a resource for the community, and we have a lot of knowledge that we need to pass on to the younger people. Don't you think, John?
Oh, yeah. Come by anytime, and on Sunday at a market, and we'll be glad to talk to you about any plant you have.
And want to encourage people to, if they have creeks, to think about planting pawpaws. It tends to like a little bit of sun, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I grow mine in right in direct sun. A lot of people say you grow them in the shade, and I've tried that, and it works. They'll grow as well in the shade as they do in the sun.
So it seems that, to me, a place that is along a creek in our area should have pawpaw trees, should have Sochin plants that also like it, and there are some good creeks for also putting in wasabi. Have you ever dealt with wasabi?
That's a new one on me.
Yeah. Wasabi's kind of like a horseradish.
Oh, yeah.
But and watercress. Watercress. All of our creeks should be producing good food for us. We need to just move in that direction a little bit. And some of these plants that we've been talking about are part of this puzzle of putting together a resilient plan of plants and food that you can go each season and go out and get. And one of the things that I would like people to understand right now is that we are at the peak of the chickweed season. Chickweed for chickweed pesto, substitute the chickweed for the basil, and instead of pine nuts, add walnuts, black walnuts, and instead of the garlic, you can add ramps. And we're going to be having a program, hopefully, coming up soon, that'll be talking about all the different types of pesto and why that's really important for us to have in our diet. Well, John, looks like we're coming to the end of this program. I want to thank you again for being able to come on with your schedule, and this has been a great opportunity to explain to the community some of the assets that we have here that they can use to be a resilient community that we love to be. And we just got Marshall did, and I think Madison County got some money for doing some unusual work. The governor was just here and left some money around in a new block grant, and by golly, by gee, I think we ought to be part of that block grant by putting in more edible fruits and plants for the whole community to become more and more resilient. And any last words, John, that you can think of?
No, just come by and say, man, Bob or I, and we'll be glad to help you out with any of these plants that maybe he would know something about them that you might not know or you're wanting to learn, and we'll be glad to help you.
Okay. So
Bahujo ne he ono